little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics, and my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Menten. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Bob.
Well, I'm excited to talk about a topic that we have not covered. We've covered a lot of topics on Thinking Clearly. There's a realm of topics that you can talk about and think about when you're thinking about the issues involved with critical thinking. But we've maybe mentioned this before, but not really covered it at any length. And I always like to give a little bit of relationship of what we're going to talk about on this particular episode. And this is it. I looked at our formal working definition of critical thinking, along with its longer description, and we've talked about that many times on this show. But I did a word count on it, Julia, and it's 150 words long with the mindsets that we think are important with critical thinking. It's 150 words long. But if I was actually forced to say what critical thinking is in 5 words or less, I would say critical thinking is logic-driven, evidence-based thinking. And it's the term evidence-based that clues us to the focus of this episode. So let's all put on our MITGA caps to encourage everybody to make thinking great again.
On this episode, we'll focus on the topic of policymaking, as Bob mentioned, specifically evidence-based policymaking, including answers to the questions such as, what is evidence-based policymaking? How does the process of evidence-based policymaking differ from other ways that policies are made? How do both empirically based facts and human values play a part in that process? And what can be done to incentivize evidence-based policymaking?
It's our great pleasure to have with us a man who was gracious enough to take off his third millennium thinking hat, which he wore with us on a previous episode talking about a book that he co-authored called just that, Third Millennium Thinking. And now he returned with us sporting his evidence-based policy hat to discuss that topic with us. So our guest, Robert McCoon, is a social psychologist and public policy analyst. He's currently professor of law at Stanford University, and prior to that was a faculty member of both the Law School and the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. And his academic background includes a bachelor's and a master's degree in psychology and a PhD in psychology from Michigan State University, and then subsequent postdoctoral work at Northwestern University. And with interests at the nexus between law and psychology, Professor McCoon has a long list of publications on a wide variety of topics, earning him multiple awards, including an award from the Association of Psychological Science for a lifetime of outstanding contributions to applied psychological research. And then a book he co-authored in 2001, titled The Drug War Heresies, was proclaimed by The Nation magazine as, quote, an enormously important book likely to become indispensable, end quote. Professor McCoon, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Great to be back. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Let's just dive right in. I'll be honest, not everyone will find policymaking to be the most exciting subject in the world. So it really makes me wonder what got you interested in policymaking, and maybe you can give us a little bit of history about what brought you to that work. And since you're known for engaging in policies that involve hot button issues, tell us what some of those issues are and what draws you to controversial issues.
My training is in experimental social psychology. So I really started that not interested in public policy per se. I was really interested in the psychology of people interacting with other people. And my professional life has been a series of accidents, happy accidents. And one of those happy accidents was as a graduate student getting hired as a research assistant with Norbert Kerr, who was studying jury decision making. So suddenly we were looking at small group behavior like a social psychologist does, but we were also looking at it in the context of ordinary citizens trying to reach verdicts in criminal trials. And I quickly found that I got very interested in some of the legal policy questions, not just the psychological questions. So for example, the question of, it doesn't matter whether we have 12-person juries or 6-person juries. Should we withhold certain evidence from juries because it's potentially biasing? What questions should go to a judge? What questions should go to a jury? So early on, I found myself really drawn to these legal policy questions, and I did not get formal legal training. I'm in the strange position of being a full professor of law at Stanford Law School, but I've never taken a class in law. But my whole career, I've studied these legal policy questions, and because of the work I was doing on jury decision making and legal policy, I got hired by the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica, California. And for 7 years, I worked there. So RAND is a nonpartisan public policy. You know, at the time it was called a think tank. I think RAND doesn't really like to be called a think tank anymore because the term has become synonymous with a certain kind of ideological organization. And RAND is anything but that. RAND, I mean, to the extent there is any ideology at RAND, it's empiricism. It's the notion of being evidence-based. It's a notion of actually analyzing public policies and possible interventions to see what their effects would be and trying to make decisions based on the evidence rather than based on ideology. Because I was interested in psychology of public policy, lots of opportunities kept arising just through controversies in the news where I could, you know, try to inform those policies from a psychological perspective. So, two of the examples I hope we'll talk about today are illicit drugs, recreational drugs, and the questions of what would happen if you legalized drugs. Another issue was the question of whether to allow gays and lesbians to serve openly in the U.S. military, which was enormously controversial in the 1990s and early 2000s. So I got to work on both of those issues, trying to figure out what does the evidence actually tell us about what would happen if we made these changes. It's been important for me in those areas to try to build up trust of very different audiences who have very different ideological views and try to get them to trust me as an honest broker who will tell them what the evidence says. And that's always a challenge. It's, you know, winning that trust is always a challenge. There's often great suspicion of experts and experts importing secret biases or secret ideology into their work. And those are valid concerns.
We will concentrate on those aspects in some detail. But before we do, even though policies can really drastically affect our lives, you know, I have the opinion that most people don't know much, if anything at all, about how policies are made. So that idea of policy making is sort of, well, somebody makes a policy somewhere, but we really don't understand that process. So let's start in a general way by sketching a picture of policy making. What is it? And what are the range of settings where policy is made? And especially those where policies affect many lives. And what are some of the typical processes for making policy? And then, I know this is a lot of questions, but what makes evidence-based policy unique?
I'm glad you asked this question about what is policy making, because when I was working at the RAND Corporation, and I would describe myself as a professional public policy analyst, I think a lot of people thought I was talking about like insurance policies, or, you know, they just had no idea what that even meant. Most of us are familiar with the idea that Congress passes laws. So we know what lawmaking is, but lawmaking is done at a very high level of abstraction. And laws point to the general directions the country is going to take on some issue. But to actually implement those laws, this is where public policy comes in. There are many different ways you could implement. So let's take the laws that make it a felony to possess heroin or cocaine or LSD. The law at a very high level states that those are felonies, but the actual details of how that prohibition gets enforced and implemented, there are a variety of ways you can implement prohibition. You know, how aggressive you are about surveillance and trying to detect whether people are using drugs. What's the probability someone will actually get arrested? What's the most likely sanction? Is that sanction going to involve incarceration, or is it a sanction, an economic sanction, like a fine? Or is it mandated treatment? And so if you look across modern societies, most modern societies have some form of drug prohibition, but there are enormous differences between the way the Norwegian government implements prohibition, the US government implements prohibition, the German government, and so on, Singapore. So policy analysts are really, it's, you know, as the saying goes, the devil's in the details, trying to figure out the details of how to actually implement these policies. What is the most effective way to translate a law into actual actions? And importantly, checking, is it working? Is it doing what we thought it was going to do? Or is it failing to meet the intended goals that the legislators had? And so that's where evidence-based policy making comes in, actually not just making public policies, but continually evaluating them, assessing whether they're working.
So the laws are made by the legislatures. If it's a federal law, it's Congress who's making the laws. Who makes the policy on actually how that law is going to be enforced?
Well, so there's a division of labor between the legislature and the executive branch. And so the executive branch does the actual implementing, and they have a great deal of leeway to interpret, unless Congress is extremely specific about how something needs to be implemented. There's usually a great deal of leeway for the executive to decide how to implement it. I'm oversimplifying a bit because laws are made by Congress, but rules and regulations are made by the executive branch, and those are also public policies. And then laws are interpreted by the courts, especially at the higher level, the Supreme Court, the appellate courts. And so they play a big role in articulating what the policy is. But in the end, no matter which branch of government is originating the rule or the policy, it has to get implemented by real people making real choices about how aggressively to enforce, how to interpret different terms. I know we'll talk about this, but in the gays in the military issue, there was an outright ban on gays and lesbians serving openly in the U.S. military. But then the Clinton administration adopted this new policy called Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Well, that sounds like something very different than the outright ban. And it was. It was a different way of enforcing the ban, but it was still a ban. It was the notion that you're still not allowed to serve openly, but the difference is we're not going to ask you. As long as you keep it quiet, keep your sexual orientation to yourself, we're not going to ask you. So that was a change of implementation of a policy. You know, it had a certain logic to it. I think it turned out to be not a very effective choice. It was very difficult to implement. And part of our role in that domain of public policy was trying to look at, can people openly express their sexual orientation in a way that is consistent with the military standards for performance, what they call unit cohesion and combat effectiveness? And is it possible to allow people to openly share things about their personal life without impairing those goals? So we, you know, what we try to do when we're doing evidence-based policymaking is move away from the ideological level to actual empirical questions like, what happens to a military unit when they find out that one of their members is gay or lesbian? Does that translate into somehow the unit working less effectively? And those are things that you can actually observe, you can actually measure, you can find out how serious the consequences are, and trying to move away from the ideological level to the actual.
If we're talking about the federal system, Congress makes the laws, and then the administration, the presidential administration, it's not the president himself. Would that be the Justice Department that makes policy? Who would make the policy?
So in the case of drug prohibition, it's heavily influenced by the Drug Enforcement Agency, the DEA's interpretation of drug prohibition, and that involves things like attempting to seize drugs at the border, you know, searching people, seizing drugs, crackdowns on source countries that are growing, say, poppy fields, actually military interventions to try to crack down there. But also at the street level, and here it's done more at the state and local level, if you observe someone using a recreational drug, do you decide to make an arrest or not? Do you pose as a buyer and try to entrap a dealer by getting them to sell you the drug and then you make the arrest? These are all implementation decisions. Something we often forget is that the actual people on the field who are enforcing our laws have enormous discretion to decide whether or not to enforce them. If you go on a ride along with police officers in an American city, they will point out to you drug dealers on the corner, and you may even see transactions taking place, and they don't rush over and make the arrest. And you're like, oh, I notice you're not making the arrest. Oh, well, you know, we couldn't possibly make every arrest every single time we see a transaction. So what you come to learn is that the agents of enforcement of our policies have a lot of discretion as to whether they actually implement the policies. And that, again, raises these empirical questions of, is the law actually being implemented as intended? Is it actually working?
So laws are more formal. They're written down. Sure, they're up for interpretation, but they're more formal. There is a real process to changing the law. Whereas policy is more sort of loosey-goosey, it sounds like. A policy can be all the way down to the local police, and they have their own unwritten, probably, policies of what they enforce and what they won't. So is that fair to say?
Yes, that's right. So, I do think the nature of the written law is quite important, and my colleagues at the law school really specialize in getting the written law right, you know, making sure that the law is written in a careful way. But that still leaves enormous range of variation and how different jurisdictions and different officers of implementation will actually implement the law.
So as a policy maker, if you're looking to hopefully implement evidence-based policy into the whole process, as the policy maker, who are you actually working with at that time to implement the policy?
Well, so right now we're going through this this process of the incoming presidential administration naming their, or at least proposing their cabinet officers. Each of those cabinet officers is going to be in charge of an enormous bureaucracy. They will be sitting up at the top of this bureaucracy trying to enforce a vision. And, you know, so a lot of the discussion we're having right now of what kind of vision do these people have? How alarmed should we be about some of their visions conflicting with our own views of what that agency should do? But actually, you know, one of the real challenges for someone who suddenly becomes secretary of blank, whatever the branch of government is, they have hundreds or thousands of people working under them and trying to actually get all those people to act with one vision to enforce the view at the top is enormously difficult and pretty much impossible to perfectly achieve. So there's, you know, so they're all going to face enormous management problems. And that would be true in any administration. It's true in the Biden administration. It'll be true in the Trump administration. And, you know, for me as a psychologist, that's where a lot of the psychology comes in, because we often give lip service to certain ideals of what we're trying to do, but actual human behavior often departs from, you know, we all make personal policy decisions on January 1st. We wake up, say Happy New Year, and drink our mimosa, and then we make our list of personal policy decisions for the coming year. And mine usually involve all the exercise I'm going to do and certain changes I'm going to make in my diet. But usually around December of that year, I will be looking back with despair about my failure to implement all my well thought out personal policy decisions. And that's where the human psychology comes in.
Yeah, it is a bit like sausage making. Mm-hmm. It's hard to really get a good map and a good picture. It's not just certain people sitting down at certain times that are developing the whole policy for some law that's been written, correct? I mean, it happens in multiple venues. Is that, I'm still trying to get an idea of, if I was somebody who really wanted to implement evidence-based policy, and we'll get into talking about the details of that, but if I was somebody who wanted to do that, how would I do that? How would I bring that into the arena?
Well, for starters, most original public policy ideas are premised on certain assumptions about the human actor. For example, in the law, we have this notion, this idealized notion called the legal actor. And the legal actor is someone who acts rationally based on veridical perceptions of the outside world. They have, people can accurately perceive the world around them, and then they rationally act on those in accordance with their preferences and tastes. And so people have preferences and they have beliefs, and then they combine those rationally into rational actions. And so lawyers, what they're trying to do is change the incentive system in the world so that rational actors will change their conduct accordingly. But as a psychologist, immediately when we start looking at these laws, they make all sorts of assumptions about rationality, about self-interest, that are problematic, that don't really correspond to how people actually behave. In the criminal law, we assume that if we change the length of the expected incarceration sentence, that people will simply dial down their criminal behavior accordingly. They'll say, oop, the penalties have gotten too high, so now I'm going to be less likely to engage in this behavior. Empirically, we can test and see, is it actually true that if you ratchet up criminal penalties, does that reliably produce a reduction in criminal behavior? And it turns out it really doesn't. You know, one of the things we've known for quite some time is that the severity of penalties has very little effect on people's behavior. And that seems puzzling from this rational choice perspective, but it becomes less puzzling when you realize, first of all, people don't really think they're going to get caught. And so if you don't think you're going to get caught, you don't think you're ever going to see that really severe punishment. Second of all, people are extremely myopic in focusing on immediate consequences of an action. And we have great difficulty in weighing long-term consequences that won't be experienced until the more distant future. So yeah, it may be that we've doubled the prison length from 10 years to 20 years. But, you know, a young man who's engaged in some income-generating crime, they're not thinking 20 years ahead. They're not thinking 10 years ahead. They're not even thinking a month ahead. They're not even thinking necessarily about tomorrow. They're very present oriented. And so that, you know, that's where psychology comes in, and trying to make sure our policies are based on more realistic assessment of what people are really doing.
We got into the differences between descriptive issues and normative issues a little bit in our previous episode with you when we talked about the chapter in Third Millennium Thinking called Weaving Facts and Values, something we often try and tackle here on Thinking Clearly. Let's review that important distinction and then talk about how values enter into evidence-based policymaking.
It's hard to find anyone who would say they're against evidence-based policymaking. Everybody thinks that they believe in evidence. But it's an exercise I had students in a seminar this year go back and study transcripts of presidential debates over the past 40 years. And I asked them to actually count how many times a candidate actually listed some source of factual evidence for something they were saying. And I also asked them to count how many times did either their opponent or the interviewer, the moderator, ask them to provide a source. And they came back quite surprised at how seldom candidates actually cite sources of evidence for their statements. And this really hits at this distinction between descriptive and normative statements. Now, descriptions are statements of how the world is. Normative statements are statements of how we think the world should be. So they're aspirational. There are ideals for how we want the world to be. And values are vitally important to politics. We need to decide where we're driving to before we start driving, and values help to inform that. And so I certainly wouldn't argue that evidence-based policy is somehow contrary to values. But what we try to do in evidence-based policymaking is just make sure that we have a firm description of what's actually true. How are people currently behaving? What are the current problems we're experiencing? When we make a change in policy, how is that going to actually translate into observable outcomes in the world? And so even though all policymakers think they're open to that evidence, the reality is, in practice, it's very difficult to get policymakers to focus on the descriptive aspects, to try to get the facts right. And that's often seen as antithetical to people's ideology. If you have a good ideology, if you have an ideology that works for you, it can give you a ready-made answer to every question. And I am not a very ideological person. And sometimes I feel envious of the people on the extreme right and the extreme left, because they know exactly what they think about every issue. I don't know what, the world is just much more complicated for me. I actually want to know, you know, what's true, not just what do we want things to be, but what's actually true. Will a certain policy work or not? And that's where I feel my value added is in the process, is trying to bring that evidence to bear.
I'm curious, are there times that you have been working with policymakers or trying to move in that direction, and you had difficulty with bringing evidence-based information, kind of coming to a head with other people's values, maybe? Some things that I feel very ideological about, and it might be hard for me to see or hear people bringing evidence-based information to me being clouded by my values.
Yeah, so an example would be in debate about gays and lesbians serving in the U.S. military. At the time that in the Clinton administration, when Bill Clinton proposed ending the ban, a lot of people in the military were very opposed to this. Now, I think the reality was a lot of them were opposed because of their personal feelings about homosexuality and their personal discomfort with the topic and lack of familiarity with the topic. They also had views of equating male homosexuality with femininity, and the military is a very macho organization, but it took me a while to figure out exactly how they were thinking about the issue, because for them, combat effectiveness was being driven by something called unit cohesion. And unit cohesion was almost this sacred concept in the military. And so I really had to probe and understand, what does unit cohesion mean in the military context? Well, in the military context, unit cohesion is this notion of a bonding that takes place, the so-called band of brothers, where the unit bonds together and works together as a team toward collective goals. Rather than each individual just pursuing their own personal goals, they work collectively as a team. And that is, I think, demonstrably quite important for effective military performance. I think there's a lot of evidence that teams that fail to work together fail to be effective military units. The problem was that they assumed that bonding only takes place if you like and approve of all your fellow members. And so if someone has a different sexual orientation than you, the notion was somehow that, you have a 12-person unit, one person comes out gay, and the whole unit collapses and falls apart. And that just, as a social psychologist, that was just not plausible to me. I mean, what we know really happens is if one person is different than the other 11 people in a 12-person group, that person gets ostracized. The group doesn't fall apart. If anything, the rest of the group bonds together even more strongly. And so a big part of my role there was to actually look at both military evidence, but also evidence from sports teams and from organizational groups to see, what are the predictors of cohesion that lead to performance? And what I ended up showing was overwhelming. The evidence showed that the recipe for cohesion is shared sense, shared commitment to the unit's mission. When I looked to see, is it true that cohesion is driven by how much you like each other? The evidence suggested that no, that was not an important component of effective teams. And so I made this distinction. I'm not the first person to make the distinction, but I drew on this distinction that goes by different names. But I use the labels task cohesion and social cohesion. So task cohesion is this shared sense of mission. Social cohesion is how much you like each other. And it took years for me to try to persuade military leaders, because task cohesion was the crucial component, not social cohesion, it would be possible for gays and lesbians to serve in units without the unit breaking down. Now, in the end, I think what was probably most persuasive to them was when other countries lifted the ban and their militaries didn't fall apart. Now, actually, it mattered which country. So, for example, when I told them that Norway and the Netherlands, in meetings I would have with military officials, and I would say, the Netherlands and Norway have ended their ban, and I would start to talk about, and that their units didn't fall apart, they would put their hand up and say, don't tell me about Norway and the Netherlands, I'm not really interested. But then when Israel adopted a non-discrimination policy, suddenly they were like, okay, Israel we take really seriously. Israel, one of the best fighting forces in the world. And what happened in Israel when they stopped banning gays and lesbians? Nothing. The units just went on functioning normally, because in fact, it just wasn't really crucial to military effectiveness, how much you like each other. I think also people have this notion that if they, straight people in the military thought they had never met gay people, and they thought they would hate them if they met them. And the reality is they had known gay people all their life, they just didn't know. And I think we as a society have come to realize that gay people are just not that different than anybody else. And so these things take time. It's not like I just present the research findings and immediately they say, oh, we didn't, yeah, now you tell us, we didn't understand that. You know, the reality is it takes a long time to get people to look at actual behavioral evidence and change their minds.
And this is great because this is exactly what I was hoping that we would do, is to use some example and bring to life how this actually works. So let's stick with that example and get a little deeper into this. What was the venue as you were working with people on this particular policy? At what level were you discussing this, and who's some of the personnel? I mean, not by their names.
This was the situation. So the president, this happened, I was involved in the process twice, first in the Clinton administration and then in the Obama administration. So in the Clinton administration in 1993, he proposed lifting the ban, but he called for study of the issue first. And I was part of an interdisciplinary team assembled to address for the Department of Defense, so this was commissioned by the Department of Defense, whether it was possible to lift the ban on gays and lesbians serving in a manner that was consistent with unit cohesion and military effectiveness. So we had a very cooperative relationship with all the services, and they enabled us to tour the facilities. You know, I spent a day touring submarines and the Navy's submarines, and then having them show me shower facilities and bunks and what the actual living conditions were like. We did focus groups with both straight and very secretive focus groups with closeted gay members of the service to hear about their concerns and their beliefs. I met with the head chaplains of the different services to talk with them about religious beliefs, and so it was a lot of consultation, but also asking them for all the internal evidence they had on military performance and effectiveness, the internal studies they had done of cohesion over the years. I had a stack, 3 feet high of studies of these various military studies that had been done, actually pouring through that, trying to see what did they actually learn in these studies.
That's really interesting because, now I'm getting a better picture where and how policy making takes place. This is personnel from the Department of Defense that you're meeting with. And is it pretty much all the same personnel for each of the meetings?
Or? No. We met with countless people. So,
okay.
There were some meetings at the Pentagon with high-ranking officials, but we drove out to various military facilities and met with people there as well. And we really tried to talk to people at all different levels, including, talking to people at the rank and file level who are actually the ones who are going to have to work with open gays and lesbians and hearing about their concerns.
But with the at the level that they're actually going to make the policy decisions, was that pretty much the same personnel?
Well, strictly speaking, the president could make the change with this, by himself. He didn't, he could make the change and just tell the military, I've made this change. But the political reality, which Clinton realized right away, was he was very unpopular with the Pentagon because he was the first person who was called a draft dodger who was in the White House. We've had subsequent people who could have served and didn't serve, but he knew that there was going to be an enormous implementation problem. And famously, Harry Truman tried to implement racial desegregation in the military, and initially received tremendous opposition, and refusal to go along, not always outright defiance, but a lot of it takes the form of passive aggressive, just failing to implement policies. Now, in Truman's case, he ended up having to threaten to fire some people to get their attention. So he used the stick to get his way. But I think the Clinton administration and later the Obama administration, they believed in consultation. They wanted buy-in. They wanted to make sure everyone knew their concerns had been heard and addressed. Now, the Clinton administration did not lift the ban. They implemented this don't ask, don't tell, which is basically kind of a fig leaf. No one was happy with don't ask, don't tell. The people who favored the ban didn't like don't ask, don't tell because they wanted a clear ban. The people who opposed the ban wanted a clear act of rescinding the ban. So everybody was unhappy. And when the issue came back up in the Obama administration, it was time to take a second look. And so we reconvened this, interdisciplinary team. I was on both teams. There were a lot of new people the second time around. But when I say interdisciplinary, I mean, we had economists, anthropologists, physicians, psychologists, political scientists. We had civilians, but also members of the military forces on the team. So we thought it was really important to bring this interdisciplinary perspective because it's a very multifaceted problem. The big difference in the Obama administration is that there were a lot more militaries that had actually made this change. And we were able to show that in 93, we said it will be relatively easy to make this change. There will be very few problems. In 2010, we were able to say, we predicted that there'd be very few problems. And now we can actually tell you what happened in Canada, in Israel, in Great Britain, when they lifted the ban, in various cities that lifted the bans in police and fire departments. And now we've got lots of evidence that says, just as we predicted, it's just no big deal. The policy changes and the sky doesn't fall. So I think we had a lot of credibility the second time around because we had made very clear projections of what would happen. But now we were able to actually point to evidence and say, look, this is what we told you. And it looks like we were right.
What I'm trying to do is to get in my mind an idea of the ingredients that take place in these processes. So I get that evidence-based approach looks at both the evidence. Is it going to be workable? How effective is it going to be? Is there any track records that you can look at where those kinds of policies have been implemented? And also look at the values that are involved, because that's so critical in terms of whether people buy into the policy or not. Because if the cops don't buy into a certain policy, they're not going to enforce it, So people's values is another part, and we've talked about that. I can see that. But as you were talking, I also began to identify other things like trust and building a relationship. And that's why I was trying to get the idea of, were you working with policymakers long enough that you could actually build some trust and relationship with them? Was that a part of the process?
It is a part of the process. I should say it's happening at multiple levels, and it's partly happening at an institutional level. So I was working at the RAND Corporation at the time, and RAND had worked very hard for many decades to build a relationship of trust with the U.S. military by doing evidence-based policy analysis for the military. They had built up a reputation as being honest brokers, not being ideologues, respecting the goals of the military, but doing very credible analysis. And so we were building on a reputation that was already there. For me coming in, I was acutely aware that I am not a military veteran. And right away, that was a source of some tension when I would meet with members of the military, and I was pretty young at the time. They don't want some young kid who hasn't even been in the military suddenly telling them how the military works. And so I learned early on, you know, I can't act like a know-it-all. I have to come in showing that I want to learn, that I want to understand the problem, and that I want to make sure I'm respecting the goals that the military has and the values that the military has. I mean, the military has a very strong core set of values involving personal integrity and honor and courage. And I needed to show that I was taking those seriously, that it wasn't just like, this isn't just some team that's building shoes in a shoe factory. You know, these are people who are fighting for ideals, and they're supposed to have this code of honor. And so I had to listen, and I had to show that I respected those values, and that I wasn't trying to undermine those or give those short shrift. I think that was really important.
Earlier, you brought up something interesting, which is, you know, that Truman used the stick, and that there's also options to incentivize policymaking. I just find this really interesting. What can be done, especially in the venues of, you know, state and federal government, to incentivize evidence-based policymaking instead of maybe some of this more value-driven stuff?
It can be very dispiriting at the ground level, at the street level, for the actual agents of enforcement of a policy to be doing something that doesn't actually seem to be achieving its goals. And it can be very easy at the very high levels of government to talk in abstractions, like the notion of securing the border, the notion of having the strongest military fighting force in the world, the notion of zero tolerance for recreational drugs, to talk about these abstractions. But the people who are actually down at the street level enforcing, they see what's really going on, and they know whether what they're doing seems to be working or not. And I'm not talking about working in terms of police officers who actually favor drug use and they don't like the idea of cracking down on drug use. No, the police officers, they want to crack down. They see drug use as a health threat and a safety threat, but they don't think what they're doing is actually making people healthier or safer. And so down at the street level, they often know when things just aren't working. However, they still have a commitment to the goals of the policy, and they don't want to be seen as disloyal to the goals of the policy. And this is part of the challenge. So if a social scientist comes in and they're focusing on the conduct of the police, and they start focusing on the problem of police officers killing civilians and possible evidence that there's racial disproportionality in when that happens, and you have social scientists who come across as if they don't like the police. They don't believe in policing. They don't believe in having a strong police force that can enforce safety on the streets. And if the police think they're dealing with someone who doesn't even respect what they're trying to do, that social scientist is not only going to fail to be effective, but they're probably going to be counterproductive. They're simply going to create disdain among the officers. I think in the same thing in the military is if social scientists come in, especially, you know, those of us who came of age in the 1960s and 1970s, if social scientists come in with this very hostile view of the military as the military being inherently some sort of immoral force, you're not going to be seen as an honest broker of the evidence. You're going to be seen as having an axe to grind. And so, I mean, social scientists are disproportionately liberal. And social scientists, we flatter ourselves that the truth is on our side, and we feel very self-righteous about that. But an awful lot of social scientists don't acknowledge how much their own personal political views and ideology are clouding the way they approach their research. And then we complain that we're not more effective. Why aren't these people listening to us? How can people be so stupid as not to listen to our evidence? Well, it's because we're not seen as honest brokers. And, you know, although my own voting patterns are left of center, I think it's an enormous problem that we face that universities are disproportionately, university professors are disproportionately left of center, and there isn't much representation. So we end up seeming like we have a thumb on the scale, that we have a thumb on the left side of the scale. We're trying to help the left side of the scale win over the right side. And as a result, we don't have very much effectiveness in persuading people. And I think that it behooves us to try to figure out how to truly be seen as trustworthy, honest brokers. And it's not easy. It's not easy to.
So again, it comes back to trust and building relationships, which kind of wraps into a lot of the themes that we've had in the last number of episodes on thinking clearly, is that the idea of just flat presenting evidence or being confrontational and trying to aggressively persuade doesn't work. If we're talking about beliefs, we're talking about issues with other people, discussing politics at Thanksgiving, whatever we're doing, that it's good for us to be critical thinkers and try to get our beliefs to be as evidence-based and realistically based as possible. But when we're interacting with people who think differently, have different beliefs, then the emphasis needs to be on charitability of our arguments and discussions, civil dialogue, building trust and relationships. So it kind of goes back, and it sounds like there's a big part of that really in evidence-based policymaking, trying to implement that in these different venues too. And well, we're running short on time, a lot still to talk about, but let's move to just a quick idea of a couple things. Are there any resources out there to learn more about evidence-based policymaking? Now, I'm going to put as a link your introduction to a course, a Stanford course on policy analysis that's on YouTube. And so that's good. We'll put that as a link. But there are any, if people want to learn more about the issue of evidence-based policy and policymaking in general, are there any resources out there that you can suggest?
Sure. So first of all, I didn't know I was on YouTube.
You are.
News to me. But I stand by whatever I say in the lectures. I guess that's okay. So certainly some of these ideas do come up in ordinary undergraduate courses in political science and talking about government. But the reality is, the way we teach government, the way we teach policy, is at this high level of abstraction about the big core ideas. And it's not really about being evidence-based. And as a result, I think a lot of people don't really have a sense for what it actually looks like to really test your policies. And so one of the things we tried to do in Third Millennium Thinking, although the book is not primarily about public policy, but it is about collective reality testing, that the need to actually understand how the world works if we're going to solve problems, that we can't solve problems unless we actually accurately understand how the world works. And that means working with people we disagree. So we tried to write the book to sort of introduce this general framework. There is there's a wonderful, very small paperback book by Eugene Bardach, B-A-R-D-A-C-H. And unfortunately, he changed the title multiple times. There are like 7 editions, and the title has changed several times. I still think of it by the title it's best known among policy analysts, which is The Eightfold Path of Policy Analysis. I think that might actually be the subtitle now, but it's a very short book, but it really walks you through all the steps of defining a problem, defining the alternative courses of action, identifying the criteria by which you're going to evaluate the alternatives, collecting the evidence, identifying the trade-offs. I mean, a key idea in public policy analysis is that there are usually trade-offs. There's no perfect solution. We usually have a choice of different public policy interventions, one of which may help us maximize one of our goals, like economic efficiency, another which might be better at maximizing another thing we care about, which would be social equity or fairness. And, you know, identifying the trade-offs and negotiating the trade-offs is a key theme of Jean Bardach's book, and I highly recommend that book.
There's so much more to talk about. Julia, have you gotten a better idea of, you know, what policymaking is all about? And I think it fits very well into what things that we've been talking about on Thinking Clearly.
It's also given me a lot to think about my New Year's resolution list. So, yes, it's been very informative. Thank you.
Professor McCoon, thank you so much for being our guest once again, this time to share your special expertise in policymaking and helping us explore the virtues and the process of evidence-based policymaking. So on our Facebook page, we're going to post links to your Stanford faculty webpage, a link to your books, to your Twitter account, and to that Elements of Policy Analysis Module 1 that you did and is available on YouTube. Are there any other links that you'd like us to post?
No, that sounds good. Thank you.
We here at Thinking Clearly are all about logic-driven, evidence-based thinking. And I want to make thinking great again by waving my Make Thinking Great Again hat to our listening audience to thank them, our listening audience, for their support. And as always, thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking.
Clearly again.